Sandcastles by Richard Brautigan. Strange fences grow on Point Reyes Peninsula, which is fastened like a haunted fingerprint to the California coast. Odd perspectives are constantly drifting out of sight or becoming too intimate in this place where white medieval Portuguese dairies suddenly appear cradled by cypress trees and then disappear as they've never really been there at all. Hawks circle in the sky like the lost springs of old railroad watches looking for correct protein wandering somewhere below to swoop down upon and devour chronologically. It's not often that I journey to Point Reyes because, frankly, my mind is seldom in that place. But when I do go there, I always enjoy myself. That is, if enjoy is the right word, driving down a road lined with fences that look like cemeteries lost in half-vague and half-mercuric spiritual density. I usually end up going to a place called McClure's Beach at the end of the peninsula. There's a parking lot where you leave your car and then it's a good hike down a gradual canyon to the beach following a small creek. Watercress grows luxuriously in the creek. There are many peculiar flowers as step by step you disappear down into the turns of the canyon until at last you arrive at the Pacific Ocean and a dramatic beach like a photograph if they'd had cameras in the days when Christ lived. And now you're part of the photograph, but sometimes you have to pinch yourself to make sure you're really there. I remember one afternoon many years ago I went with a friend to Point Reyes where my mind was exactly in that kind of place and stared at the fences as we drove deeper and deeper into the peninsula, which of course unfolded like layers of abstraction and intimacy constantly being circled by hawks. We parked at McClure's Beach. I remember very clearly the sound of the car being parked. It made a lot of noise. There were some other cars parked there. Even after our car was parked, totally silent, it was still making noise. Warm fog swirled in the canyon as we gradually descended. 100 feet in front of us, everything was lost in the fog. And 100 feet behind us, everything was lost in the fog. We were walking in a capsule between amnesias. There were hushed flowers all around us. The flowers looked as if they had been painted by a 14th century anonymous French painter. My friend and I had not said anything to each other for a long time. Perhaps our tongues had joined the brushes of that painter. I stared at the watercress in the creek. It looked wealthy. Whenever I see watercress, which isn't very often, I think of the rich. I think they are the only people who can afford it. And they use watercress in exotic recipes that they keep hidden in vaults from the poor. Suddenly, we went around a turn in the canyon, and there were 5 handsome teenage boys in swimming suits burying 5 pretty teenage girls in the sand. They were all carved from classical California physical marble. The girls had arrived at various stages of being buried. One of them was completely buried with only her head above the sand. She was very beautiful with long black hair stretched out along the sand as if it were some kind of dark water, perhaps jade, flowing out of her head. The girls were all very happy being buried in the sand, and so were the boys who were burying them in the sand.
It was a teenage graveyard party because they had run out of everything else to do. They were surrounded by towels, beer cans, beach baskets, picnic leftovers, etc. They gave us no particular attention as we walked by and down to the Pacific Ocean, where I mentally pinched myself to make sure I was still in this Christ-powered photograph.
Greyhound tragedy. She wanted her life to be a movie magazine tragedy, like the death of a young star with long lines of people weeping and a corpse more beautiful than a great painting. But she was never able to leave the small Oregon town that she was born and raised in and go to Hollywood and die. Though it was the Depression, her life was comfortable and untouched because her father was the manager of his local Pennies and financially compassionate to his family. Movies were the religion of her life, and she attended every service with a bag of popcorn. Movie magazines were her Bible that she studied with the zealousness of a doctor of divinity. She probably knew more about movies than the Pope. The years passed like the subscriptions to her magazines. 1931, 1932, 1933, 1934, 1935, 1936, 1937, until September 2nd, 1938. Finally, it was time to make her move if she were ever going to go to Hollywood. There was a young man who wanted to marry her. Her parents were very enthusiastic about his prospects. They approved of him because he was a Ford salesman. "It's a company with a fine tradition," her father said. Things did not look good for her. She spent months building up the courage to go down to the bus station to find out how much the fare to Hollywood cost. Sometimes, she spent whole days thinking about the bus station. A few times, she even got dizzy and had to sit down. It never dawned on her that she could have called on the telephone. She made it a point during those nervous months never to go by the bus station. Thinking about it all the time was one thing, but actually seeing it was another. Once she was driving downtown with her mother, and her mother turned onto the street where the bus station was located, and she asked her mother to please turn down another street, because she wanted to buy something at a store on that street. Some shoes. Her mother thought nothing of it and made the turn. She didn't think to ask her daughter why her face was red, but that was not unusual because she seldom thought to ask her anything. One morning, she was going to talk to her about all the movie magazines that came in the mail. Some days, she would jam up the mailbox so that she would have to use a screwdriver to get the mail out. But her mother had forgotten about it by noon. Her mother's memory had never been able to last until 12. It usually pooped out around 11:30. But she was a good cook, and the recipes were simple. Time was running out like the popcorn in a Clark Gable picture. Her father had been dropping a lot of hints lately about her being out of high school for 3 years, and perhaps it was time for her to think about doing something with her life. He was not the local manager of Penny's for nothing. Recently, actually about a year ago, he'd become tired of watching his daughter sit around the house all the time reading movie magazines with her eyes wide as saucers. He'd begun to think of her as a bump on a log. Her father's hints happened to coincide with the young Ford salesman's fourth proposal of marriage. She had turned down the other three, saying that she needed time to think it over, which really meant that she was trying to build up enough courage to go down to the bus station and find out what the fare to Hollywood cost. At last, the pressure of her longings and her father's hints made her leave the house early one warm twilight after getting out of doing the dinner dishes and walk slowly down to the bus station. From March 10, 1938, until the evening of September 2, 1938, she had been wondering what the bus ticket to Hollywood cost. The bus station was stark, unromantic, and very distant from the silver screen. Two old people were sitting there on a bench waiting for a bus. The old people were tired. They wanted to be now at wherever they were going. Their suitcase was like a burned-out light bulb. The man who sold the tickets looked as if he could have sold anything. He could just as well be selling washing machines or lawn furniture as tickets to other places. She was red-faced and nervous. Her heart felt out of place in the bus station. She tried to act as if she were waiting for somebody to come in on the next bus, an aunt. She had worked desperately to build up enough courage to go ask how much it cost to go to Hollywood, but it didn't make any difference to anybody else what the game she pretended. Nobody looked at her, though she could have rented herself out as an earthquake beat. They simply didn't care. It was a stupid night in September, and she just didn't have enough nerve to find out how much the fare to Hollywood cost. She cried all the way home through the warm, gentle Oregon night, wanting to die every time her feet touched the ground. There was no wind, and all the shadows were comforting. They were like cousins to her. So she married the young Ford salesman and drove a new car every year except for the Second World War. She had two children that she named Jean and Rudolph and tried to let her beautiful movie star death go at that. But now, 31 years later, she still blushes when she passes the bus station. Women, when they put their clothes on in the morning. It's really a very beautiful exchange of values when women put their clothes on in the morning and she is brand new and you've never seen her put her clothes on before. You've been lovers and you've slept together and there's nothing more you can do about that, so it's time for her to put her clothes on. Maybe you've already had breakfast and she slipped her sweater on to cook a nice bare-ass breakfast for you, patting in sweet flesh around the kitchen, and you both discussed in length the poetry of Rilke, which she knew a great deal about, surprising you. But now it's time for her to put her clothes on because you both had so much coffee you think you can't drink anymore. And it's time for her to go home. And it's time for her to go to work. And you want to stay there alone because you got some things to do around the house. And you're going outside together for a nice walk. And it's time for you to go home. And it's time for you to go to work. And she's got some things that she wants to do around the house. Or maybe it's even love. But anyway, it's time for her to put her clothes on. And it's so beautiful when she does it. Her body slowly disappears and comes out quite nicely all in clothes. There's a virginal quality to it. She's got her clothes on, and the beginning is over.